Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we have the privilege of inviting back to the program Robert Spencer, who is the director of JihadWatch.org, and he's the author of some best-selling books on the subject of Islam. His latest book is called The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. Robert, thanks so much for joining us on Vocal Point.
Always good to be here, Jerry. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, tell us about this new book.
Well, this book is an explanation for Americans of just how much Iran is a threat, why Iran is a threat, and what we can do about that threat. Most people are not aware of these things because, of course, the Obama administration, since its inception, has been pursuing a policy of downplaying and denying the Iran threat, culminating, of course, in this ridiculous nuclear deal, which makes up the whole of Chapter 1 of the book, which I think will shock a whole lot of people in showing exactly how bad, how damaging this deal really is.
In your opinion, which is actually a greater threat to the West in general, ISIS or Iran?
They're both huge threats, but the short answer is that Iran is what ISIS wants to be when it grows up. Mm. Of course, ISIS is Sunni and Iran is Shia, but they both are Islamic states governed by Islamic law that want to rule the world. And both of them, of course, are not going to be able to rule the world, but Iran is going to be able to commit a great deal more havoc than ISIS in trying to do so. That might seem counterintuitive on the face of it, because, of course, ISIS inspires these lone wolf attackers like this truck driver in Nice who killed 84 people and the gunman in Orlando who killed 49 people and so many others. And Iran doesn't do that. But Iran is working in more subtle ways and ways that could ultimately be much more destructive to the United States. One immediate example is that it is training via Hezbollah, which is a wholly owned and operated subsidiary of Iran. Via Hezbollah, they're training the drug cartels in northern Mexico, teaching them how to kidnap, how to behead, and so on. And they're getting money from, in turn, from the drug cartels themselves. And the upshot of that is that ultimately the goal is to get into the country, into the United States, not just to work in Mexico. And that is something that could ultimately, with these trained cadres, be much more devastating than these ISIS lone wolf attacks.
Hmm. You've said, and I quote, that Iran is, and here's the quote, a breeding ground for terrorist activity, a breeding ground. Comment on that.
It is a terror factory in the sense that it controls a global network of terrorist organizations. Most people don't know, for example, what I just mentioned, that Hezbollah in Lebanon is a wholly owned and operated subsidiary of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards of Iran. And not only does Iran fund Hezbollah, but it also funds Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And it has also, in the past, funded even Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. These are all Sunni groups, and Iran is Shia. But Iran is trying to position itself as the global leader of the jihad terror movement and is indeed the chief sponsor of terror attacks around the world, the chief terror state, one could say. Not only do they fund terror groups, but they also fund, as the Ayatollah Khamenei put it, the supreme leader of Iran, any group that is anti-American, they will help out, they will support. And notably, for example, it is a far leftist political party in Spain, Podemos, that they fund. And this is no accident and no mistake either. They're trying to sow the seeds of the nothing less than the destruction of the established order in the West. And its replacement, ultimately, by an Islamic order.
So in a sense, if ISIS had its own country, then what you're saying could be, then ISIS would be a runner-up for Iran as a terror-funding state. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, well, I think in a certain sense, ISIS does have its own country. Hmm. How long-lived it will be is another thing.
Okay.
ISIS controls right now a territory larger than Great Britain, even after some territorial losses that have been inflicted upon it, notably by the Iranians.
Okay, this region that you're talking about is in Iraq and then also Syria, is that right? Parts of the...
Yes, Iraq and Syria is where ISIS is based, although they also have allegiances with terror groups in that control expanses of territory in Libya and Nigeria, and they have other allied groups elsewhere as well. And so they're a very significant force, and this is by no means to downplay them at all. But what you have is one Islamic State, that's ISIS, which calls itself, of course, the Islamic State, and you have another Islamic State, that's Iran, that is actually a much more powerful state on the world stage, a much more powerful actor on the world stage, and, of course, an established and great civilization with a long history. And so they are what ISIS is striving to become. Mm.
That's amazing. Why don't you explain the Shiite versus Sunni conflict? Because that, I think, helps to helps us to understand a lot of the Middle East conflict, to some degree at least.
Yeah, no doubt, of course, that Sunnis and Shia hate each other. And yet, at the same time, there is an old saying that in Arabic that translates to my brother against my brother, but both of us against our cousin. And so Sunni and Shia will always ally with one another against non-Muslims, against infidels. And in this case, the Sunnis and the Shia are fighting one another in the struggle between ISIS and Iran, which is playing out in Iraq. We hear about the Iraqi army rolling back ISIS, but actually it's the Iranians propping up the Iraqi army and making it possible for them to have these victories. The split is over authority. It's just over who gets to rule the Muslim community worldwide. And the Sunnis believe that it should be simply the best man from the community, although he needs to be from the Quraysh tribe that Muhammad was from.
Mm.
And the Shia believe, no, it has to be a member of Muhammad's own household. So they had a hereditary leadership until the 9th century, when the 12th Imam, the last of their leaders, went into hiding or disappeared or was killed. But in any case, the Shia understanding is that he went into occultation. He is hidden and will reappear at the end of the world to conquer and Islamize the world in the company of Jesus, the Muslim prophet, not Jesus, the Christian son of God and savior of the world, but Jesus, the Muslim prophet, who will break the crosses and destroy Christianity. The Sunnis believe that Jesus will come back and break the cross and destroy Christianity, but they don't have the 12th Imam business. They eschew all that and have a different idea of leadership. The caliphate, caliph means successor in Arabic, and the caliph is the successor of Muhammad as the military, political, and spiritual leader of the Muslims worldwide. And of course, there has not been a caliph since 1924, but the leader of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he is the self-styled new caliph, and of course, many Muslims have accepted his authority.
That is the leader of ISIS that you're talking about right there, al-Baghdadi. Okay, so, by the way, as I hear you, I, there's a devious part within me, and I can't help but think, well, why can't those Sunnis and Shiites just keep fighting each other and leave the rest of us out of this?
Well, that would be great, except they will always ally against infidels. And so that while they do fight one another, at the same time, as I said, the Iranians fund Hamas and Islamic Jihad, even though they're Sunni. And they aided, as I show in the book, they aided in the 9/11 plot by helping the Saudi Sunni hijackers get through Iran into Afghanistan for training. And
you point out in your book that they didn't get stamped their passports. There was no Iranian connection there known, because if they had had Iranian connection, then that would have been a red flag here in America.
Yes, exactly. And so their passports were falsified. So when they came back to the United States after the training, nobody thought that they had been in Iran. But it was in the 9/11 Commission report. This is not some fringe theory. These things are well documented.
Well, okay, now explain to us Obama and the Iran deal. I mean, it sounds like it's a bad deal all the way around. Why would he do this?
It seems as if Obama was thinking that he should give Iran what it wants, and that that would placate Iran and make them like us better, and that Iran would be a force for stability in the Islamic world. Neither of those things are true, but that seems to be the best understanding that anybody can put on why Obama would be empowering a regime that has considered itself to be at war with the United States since 1979.
Yeah, and you know, I hear that, and I can't help but think of, okay, what part of death to America don't we understand here?
Yeah, and John Kerry, of course, was directly confronted about that, and he said, "Oh, they don't really mean that. They don't have any plans to that show that they are working toward the destruction of America." Now, this was patently disingenuous because even as he said that, there are daily incidents in the Persian Gulf of confrontations between the Iranian Navy and the U.S. Navy, and the Iranian Navy is extremely aggressive toward the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. doesn't do anything because they don't want to have an international incident. And, of course, they don't want to get the Iranians angry and get into a war. They really are trying to avoid that. And so the incidents are generally covered up. But the fact is that Iran is essentially on a war footing against the United States that makes the deal look very bad. And so the Obama administration puts up with a great deal. Of course, the most notorious incident of this is when they actually took, captured several U.S. soldiers. Sailors who had strayed into Iranian waters. And Biden and Kerry and Obama said, oh, this is strictly routine. Their navigation equipment failed. That's all. And the Iranians were very helpful. Meanwhile, the Iranians are parading them around with blindfolds and making them kneel and treating them like prisoners of war and then crowing about how they humiliated the Americans. The cognitive dissonance was extreme.
If Iran got nuclear weapons, what then?
Well, they would destroy Israel in the first place, and they wouldn't hesitate to do that because they are inveterately hostile to the state of Israel on Islamic grounds. And if they, and also they are working from Shiite eschatology, Shiite theology about the end times, which says that this 12th Imam, their savior figure, is going to return at a time when the Muslims are more persecuted than they have ever been in history. And so that could be something that they would want to provoke for themselves by retaliatory nuclear strikes. That is, they hit Tel Aviv and then they're hit. And as a former president of Iran, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, has said, Iran could sustain 10 to 15 million casualties while Israel would be destroyed. And then, you see, those 10 to 15 million casualties could provoke the return of the 12th Imam.
Plus, I guess from their theology, those 10 to 15 million innocent people of Iran killed by the Israelis, you know, retaliatory bombing or whatever, would they be viewed as, you know, martyrs, so-called, to, you know, go to paradise?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so there's really no downside as far as the Iranians are concerned. Everybody wins.
Everybody but the world and God and Israel and the United States, et cetera. What about the United States? I mean, would they...
From the point of view of the Iranians. Iranian leadership.
Yeah, no, I understand. And now, in the meantime, how could they possibly get us here at the United States? Not that I want to give anybody any ideas.
Well, they're not working, of course, toward a army-to-army confrontation. They know they would lose that. But they are hoping to, by subversion and infiltration, ultimately bring down the United States. And they're working very effectively toward that. For example, just a few years ago, in 2012, the Canadians shut down the Iranian embassy in Ottawa because they said it was being used for terror plotting and espionage. And I'm sure that's true all over the world. And one of the chief targets of this is the United States. Of course, they don't have an embassy in Washington, but they are still working through other air avenues to bring down the United States.
Okay, we have 30 seconds left. What else do you want to say about The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran? And again, I want to give your website. It's jihadwatch.com for more information. We've been talking to Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch. Go ahead. You have got some few seconds remaining. Go ahead.
People who read The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran will be amazed at the extent and the variety of how Iran's global adventurism, of how in so many ways, it is working right now against the U.S.
You know, and I think maybe it'll be years before we realize just the incredible damage that the Obama administration has done towards real peace in the world. Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
A pleasure always, Jerry.